1805, and 21-1053. Fenester James versus City of Detroit, Michigan, et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Racer, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you very much. Good morning. We'll reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Judges, this is an important Fourth Amendment case, and I think that the most important things for you to understand, and I know you've diligently read all the briefing, is the fact that after the close of discovery and after motion practice was pending, we found that the city of Detroit, for the first time, and we never could have discovered this, was doing an internal investigation of the actual unit involved in this search. And the issue in that actual investigation was whether or not there were fake, falsified search warrants for the type of search that occurred here. Now, I want to be clear. My client is an elderly Detroiter. She was not somebody that was seen in any sort of activity at all. According to the police officers, an informant bought $10 worth of marijuana off of her front lawn, and that was the basis for the search warrant. There was no marijuana found in the house after they executed the warrant. The warrant didn't indicate that Fenester James sold anybody any marijuana. And just tangentially, I think it's important to notice that marijuana was legal as medical marijuana in the state of Michigan at the time. So in terms of your role, fortunately, our founders designed a really cool system. And they designed protections for ordinary citizens, as you know, to keep them safe from search and seizures. In this particular case, you have a governmental entity which is investigating its own for corruption. There is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that Chief Craig came out after this case had been way after discovery and had said, we're investigating this unit for fraud in obtaining search warrants. There is no other way whatsoever for us to go back and to figure out whether this particular search is fraudulent and corrupt without the court taking this back so that we can look into that issue. I think that that militates sending it back just on its own. There is no other remedy but you good judges to make sure that the Detroit Police Department did not obtain a fraudulent warrant in this case. I think that's very important. And in the earlier case, we were talking about erring on the side of caution. Well, the side to err on in this case is the enforcement of important Fourth Amendment rights. And the fact is that there is corruption in this particular unit with officers that worked side by side with every other officer involved in this. We do not know and we cannot find out through any other channel but discovery in a court case, in this case, whether or not this warrant was based upon fraud. And if it was, you'd have to agree with me that that's a Fourth Amendment violation, I believe. The other issue in this case is the knock and announce.
Are you going to go
into... We can all agree that...
Counsel, excuse me. Are you going to go into the issue of whether the execution of the warrant was violative of Fourth Amendment rights and whether there are material disputed issues of fact that should have precluded entry of summary judgment?
Judge Clay, thank you so much, because that's exactly where I was going right now after the issue I was talking about. That was my next thing to talk about. The factual issue militates that a jury decide whether there was a reasonableness in the execution of this warrant. And the fact is that the court even found that minds could differ on whether or not this was a reasonable execution of the warrant. However, the court, even though it wasn't briefed, decided it on governmental immunity with the thought that it wasn't a clearly established right that knock and announce was the law pursuant to Fourth Amendment, which is baffling. And I'm very puzzled by that because the defendant didn't argue qualified immunity in their motion. They argued that there was no reasonable question of fact for a jury. And the fact is that taking 6 to 8 seconds from exiting the van while you're yelling DPD to go right to a door to batter it down fails muster in terms of all of the case law on knock and announce. I mean, it's really pretty easy to think that that's a factual issue that has to go to a jury. I don't know what more I can say about that. I mean, the fact is that an elderly woman was in her house peering through the door when the officers battered down the door and it banged into her head, threw across the room. The bloody t-shirt is soaked. And then the officers told her, you knocked your head on something else. You didn't hurt yourself with us. They found nothing in the house that was the subject of the warrant. And it's just puzzling to me and disappointing to me that this doesn't go to a jury to decide whether that conduct was reasonable. Judge Clay, does that answer your question? I mean, I see this as a very simple issue.
Okay, if I can interrupt 1 second. I understand your argument to be, at least in part, that by raising Fourth Amendment constitutional violation, you take the position that subsumes that the knock and announce standard was not met here. But if I could back up just a little bit to the, I guess maybe the original complaint. Maybe we could start there. What provisions or paragraphs of the original complaint would you think put the defendants on notice that there is a claim that these officers did not knock and announce their presence? Is that something you can address now?
Sure. Judge Cole, we briefed the heck out of this, but let me go through my notes and get to that. The Monell claim certainly indicated that there were issues with how the officers were trained to execute search warrants.
Okay, that's the failure.
And
I'll let you continue, but I'm just wondering what other than the Monell arguments.
Sure. That's why, I mean, I think that we played a Fourth Amendment argument pretty well. And I think that subsumes knocking and announce. And I'm looking for my notes to get you those sites, and I will get those to you.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you can address those on rebuttal if you don't have them before you now.
Right.
But I just want to get a good sense of what would put the defendants on notice that there's this claim violation of knock and announce. And it just seemed that just raising the unconstitutional conduct under the Fourth Amendment generally, you know, would not just subsume every possible constitutional violation, including knock and announce. That you need to be a little bit more specific in a complaint. I'm just asking the question.
Well, we agree with you that the words knock and announce are not in the complaint. But inherent in the Fourth Amendment search and seizure claim is the method of the officer's entry into a dwelling. And that's really what knock and announce is. However, let me tell you how this developed, Judge Paul, and it's a great point that I wanted to get into.
Well,
I'm a defendant.
No, continue. I'm sorry.
Okay. When the defendant filed their motion for summary judgment on the case, we moved to amend to make the complaint clearer about knock and announce because they didn't address it in the briefing. Because we wanted to make sure we had litigated that issue back and forth and up and down all through discovery. I took the depths on this case myself. All of the depths focused on what happened, how much time there was, exactly all the facts in terms of the search. But we wanted to make it absolutely clear that issue was briefed on summary judgment. And that's why we moved to amend our complaint to make it even clearer, which the district court granted because the district court knew that we had litigated the heck out of that issue. So if the original complaint didn't state it clear enough, even though the standard for pleading is very broad, we took the additional responsibility to make sure that the defendant knew that was a briefable issue. And the defendant indeed did brief that issue extensively on our amended complaint. So even if the original complaint, given a very broad standard, wasn't specific enough, The fact is that the issue was fully briefed by the defense.
So let me ask you this. Let me just ask you this. Your time is expiring. You do use the word announce in paragraph 91 of the complaint and saying it's under sort of a state law battery, other state law claims. But there is the allegation that the officers entered, I think, forcefully and unannounced, I believe. Is that part of the knock and announce claims that that would be in the original complaint, in your view?
Yes. Yes. I think that, those are all facts which state the knock and announce violation in the complaint. But again, I think that the motion to amend made it very clear, and I think the defendant was able to fully brief that issue. They just said that it didn't amount to a question of fact. And then the court decided it on qualified immunity, which we never had an opportunity. The defendant didn't brief qualified immunity on that issue. So how the court can say that that's a qualified immunity analysis, given that Fourth Amendment knock and announce is well stated in the law, I'm very puzzled. I appreciate your questions. I agree that that's an important issue.
All right. Your time for your basic argument has expired, and we will hear from opposing counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. The defendants on behalf of the individual defendants. Thank you, Judge Crowe, for the questions you asked. Our position is that the judge correctly determined and granted summary judgment in this particular case. This was a search warrant was involved, it was a drug raid. No, the plaintiff was not involved in the transaction that they observed, but we did find cocaine in the house when we went in, and she was issued a ticket. What happened in this case, and allowed her to do this, is that it's police officers were not notified of the date, and they did not appear. And the judge dismissed their case without prejudice because we did not appear. The defendants didn't have notice, and that's another story. So we want to set that. And cocaine was found in this case. Now, the author, you have to remember, the defendant, the plaintiff in this case, filed for a motion for summary, a motion to amend way back in 2018. And it did, and court granted it and never filed it. Then, after discovery is closed, and after we filed our motion for summary judgment, our motion for summary judgment, it comes with this motion to amend. Now, the plaintiff would like you to think that it was just being helpful and so forth, but even in when it filed its motion for the amend, it admitted that it didn't. But there was some clerical mistake that it was the motion or something was not filed. So we didn't have any notice in this particular case. So the position when we filed our response to it, because we were alerted, because that would have been a significant issue, because mostly, and he emphasized this whole excessive force, just like he told you how she was beat up. But remember, he has abandoned that claim. The only claim for this was on the knock and announce. And for some reason, he abandoned that claim. And that's what we thought we were fighting tooth and nail about here. And we understood that that probably would have had more of a question of fact, although we don't believe it was. So what happened here was our position was there was no DUI issues of material fact to show that our officers violated the constitutional rights of the plaintiff. No, we did not use these words, the words qualified immunity here. And the reason why he did this, when you look at the facts, first of all, plaintiff claims she did not heed here. Now, when she claimed that she went, she was in her bathroom with the door closed, it was a big house, she's 57 years old at this time, so she's not really an old lady, because I'm that age, and I'm 57, and she's not an old lady, just wobbly and senile. And she was walking with a cane and so forth, and her bathroom door was shut. She kept saying, this is a big house, I had to walk. She claimed she didn't hear anything except that her dog barked and made her have noticed. So she never heard it. But the case law especially Peters versus Buffett said, the fact that they did not hear does not mean that they did not announce. Now, what they did was, out of the car, vehicles, they started shouting, Detroit police! Detroit police! They got out the car doing that. They went on the front porch and continued to do so on the front porch.
Counsel.
At that time,
counsel.
Yes?
The police claims that they knocked and announced and waited an appropriate time before busting into the residence. The resident didn't hear anything, and wouldn't you agree that it's a disputed issue as to whether they knocked and announced or not? We've got, the only thing we've got for that is the word of the police. And the point is not being conceded by the other side. So among the disputed issues, that would be one of them, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor. Based on Pierce versus Burkett, in those cases and the other cases we cited, the plaintiff said that they didn't hear. They did not hear, so forth. And the court has said just because they say they did not hear does not mean that they officers did not knock and announce, and they granted summary judgment here because it's based on speculation here. They were hollering, screaming, they were on the porch, they didn't knock on the door, they were screaming and hollering on there. And then we don't know how long it took her to get from there, because she said she created this scenario. The house is a big house. How long? So she has no evidence. She provides, that's the point. They don't provide any evidence. There's no evidence on their side to even dispute what we say. She just says she did not hear it. That's not sufficient in this particular case. And the officer's position was that they waited between, in a total of 15 to 18 seconds from running out the car and on the porch. They waited like 6 to 8 seconds. They didn't hear anything. They heard no noise. So they assumed. Now, Your Honor, first of all, this is a drug case. No, we did not expect to see her. They did not expect probably to see a 57-year-old woman there. But it is a drug case, so we don't know whether they're getting rid of that evidence or freshening it or what is happening. You have to be careful in these cases. No, we're not saying that we saw any big strategic circumstances, but you still, police officers, when we look that we see just on the other side, they still have to be careful in these drug raid cases.
Counsel.
And so, yes?
Excuse me. Just wanted to ask a question here. The judge granted qualified immunity without providing both sides an opportunity to address the appropriateness of qualified immunity and having the issue briefed by both sides. Don't you think that's a little problematical, that way of proceeding, that the district judge is going to pop up and grant qualified immunity and not permit it to be briefed and addressed before deciding the issue?
Your Honor, the plaintiff says that we address these issues, and our position is, no, we do not have the magic words of qualified immunity in here, and the judge determined this, but our position is that based on the arguments and based on the lack of evidence to show that there was any constitutional violation that she put forth, that it amounted to the same thing, that she properly granted the motion for summary judgment in this particular case. In this particular case. Now, McKee versus Knott, McNeil versus Knott.
Excuse me.
Okay, now.
We've got a volume problem here. We can't.
Can you hear me?
Well, I can hear you plenty well. I'm not sure you can always hear me.
Okay. Okay, I hear you, Your Honor. And so my position is, McKeel and McNeil versus Cott, they talked about the fact that the court, the judge granted a summary judgment and allowed and said it was qualified immunity, even though sua sponte, that's the whole issue here, that she did this sua sponte, the court said,
counsel,
if the arguments of the defendants
amount
to the same, yes?
As you know, there's a whole body of jurisprudence and case law pertaining to qualified immunity, and if the issue is not, if the parties don't have notice that that's now before the court for decision and an opportunity to address it, the issue is not fleshed out or appropriately briefed prior to decision. Wouldn't it have been preferable to for the court to have permitted, I know you say you addressed it without using the word, the phrase qualified immunity, but wouldn't it have been appropriate for the court to have permitted both parties to expressly address qualified immunity before ruling?
Well, in this particular case, Clinton responded back. I think they understood it. They just inspected her to say qualified rules, qualified immunity, but he responded to our arguments in this case. And our position is there was no evidence that Clinton even put forth to raise to show that there was a constitutional violation. And in this case, based on the case of McNeil versus Knott that we cited on, even though there this issue of qualified immunity, but even notwithstanding, even if she had not said qualified immunity, she probably granted motion for summary for disposition in this particular case because there were no genuine right issue in that effect, the way we argued, and it amounts to the same thing that we, the defendants, did not violate constitutional rights here in this particular case, Your Honor. Did that answer your question? Any questions? Does anyone else have any more questions on that particular issue here? Our position is that there was nothing in the record that she put forth on that issue. Now, when the judge, when they presented their 59E motion, the court had a reviewed its decision. It was about the motion to amend. And it said that it was wrong, it erred. And that's the purpose of a 59E motion, for the court to correct its own errors. It has jurisdiction to. And since it does this, suspend the tolling of the time, at that time there is no final order. And she had jurisdiction. So Clinton's argument was putting forth that it did not have jurisdiction is not so. And the case law that we have cited in there clearly negates that.
Counsel.
That is.
Counsel.
I want the judge, yes?
Okay. Isn't there a way we could get my volume to, or the court's volume to the counsel a little better so she can't hear when we're trying to interrupt for questions?
Okay.
Huh?
We've adjusted to the volume.
Oh, okay. What I was going to ask you also, the counsel, the granting of the dismissal of the amended complaint, that was pretty much sua sponte in the sense that the court, having granted the permission for the filing of the amended complaint, then dismissed it without prior notice and then having done it, didn't provide much of an explanation as to why the court was doing that. Wouldn't it have been better practice for the district judge to have, having granted the filing of the amended complaint, to have provided notice and some sort of explanation as to what was going on there?
Your Honor, in the motion for reconsideration, it explained in detail why it reversed and that it made a mistake. And Your Honor, in this case, this whole case is, and I hate to say it, is anybody can use best practices.
I'm talking about prior notice, prior to ruling, rather than doing things as a practice, sua sponte.
Well, Your Honor, that was the court's discretion. My position is that she explained why she did it, that she erred in this particular case. And even granted because the lateness of it, and that it was done, that she should not have even granted because it was after discovery was closed, and after we had filed our motion for summary judgment, and we were before summary judgment, and he comes in with this new claim here. So plaintiff was also responsible about best practices as well in this particular case. This case is covered there.
Didn't the court know all of that when it granted the granted permission to file the amended complaint?
Your Honor, without due regard, I can't tell you what was in the court's mind. And maybe she felt she made an error, she said, because she thought that, and I was worried about somebody asking me this question, but she explained that she looked at, she was addressing him, had a complaint for an issue for First Amendment rights, and that she kind of got them confused, and she made a mistake when she went on and granted on the knock and announce that she didn't mean to do that. Now, she said that right there, and I can't find where she did it, but she did say that.
She didn't. Yeah. That wasn't really exactly what she said, as you just stated it. She didn't use those. She didn't say that or use those words.
What she said in her explanation, she said that she should not have even read it. Now, I don't know what words you think that I'm twisting that she said, and I'm sorry if you believe that I am, because I don't intend to do so. The way I read what she said in the record, she thought she made a mistake in what she would consider it was the issue that she was addressing. And that's how I construed it. And I can misconstrued it, misconstrued the interpretation of that. But I'm not trying to misquote her, Your Honor.
Ms. Fagan, your time is expiring. If I could just ask one question.
Yes.
Which goes to the questions that Judge Clay has been asking. So in discovery, as I recall, the defendants did ask Ms. James questions that went to the issue of the officers announcing their presence and entry. So this was put before Ms. James, at least in that discovery process. So I guess I hearken back to the original complaint and Ms. James' argument that the complaint really did sufficiently set forth her claims that the officers did not sufficiently knock and announce here, especially when you read the various provisions of the complaint she cites, and this paragraph 91A, which says that it essentially entering plaintiff's residence forcefully and unannounced. Isn't that really sufficient to, at least for purposes of a complaint, put before the defendants that she's got this knock and announce claim, and it's the officers seem to have thought that she did because they asked those questions in discovery?
Even assuming that is so, Your Honor, our position is still that the defendants established that they did not violate a constitutional violation, that she failed to put forth proof to show the jury that the fact that she said she didn't hear, that we had said that 6 to 8 seconds, the case law says, is unreasonable here, and there was no reason here to believe that what we did was not reasonable in this case, and therefore that the court should affirm in this case that she probably granted summary.
So your position is, assuming that the complaint sufficiently set forth allegations of a knock and announce claim, that really there are no disputed facts when it comes to whether the defendant should prevail.
Right. Our position is that there are no disputed facts in this case, and the defendant should prevail in this matter, despite in this case, as I said in response, I think it was to Judge Clay, there were a lot of lack of best practices in this case. They were full of them here. But when the murder reached the road, the defendant should have been granted summary judgment because plaintiff still did not come forth here. And that this court, and then I'd like to add, I know I'm throwing it in, that the defendant, plaintiff had notice in 2019, December, about the investigations. Two articles came on newspapers. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask a question more out of curiosity than anything else. How many police officers were at the house on this occasion?
I really can't tell you the answer. I just know it's about 9 of them being sued. I'm assuming it's just 9 that was here, but I don't know how many police officers were at the house. I really don't know. And some of them were at the back. They were not all on the front porch.
Okay.
They were at the back.
Does the city of Detroit normally send that many officers out when what's at stake is a $10 bag of marijuana?
It depends on what the officers, the supervisors, and they determine on those facts about how many people they send out in this particular case. I am not going to quote and say we send out that many in every case and so forth, but the number of police officers who were there in that particular case, they thought that it was necessary. Because of it was a confidential, confidential that they had used before the transaction and to go in this house, and they didn't know what they suspected.
All right, counsel, that will do. Thank you for your argument. We'll hear rebuttal from Mr. Razor.
Thank you so much. Good job to answer your question. So the way that this worked is that there was this drug unit, and they had all these officers that did 2 or 3 or 4 houses every day based upon these ones. So they just went from house to house busting in. And obviously for a $10 bag of marijuana bought on the front yard by somebody other than the defendant, that's a lot of overkill, especially with legal medical marijuana. The fact of the matter is, an important fact is, none of the newspaper articles prior to the court granting the summary judgment talked about any of the particulars of this operation being sweet. We didn't know or couldn't have known that there was actual corruption being exposed and false warrants being granted based upon fraud by the officers in this unit until the article of October 2020. And we still don't know, because the investigation hasn't gone back far enough to capture this particular incident, whether or not the officers involved in this particular incident and this particular warrant are indicted in that investigation. So by you sending it back, we will have discovery to find that. And I would not be surprised to find that, but I can't do it in any other form. You are the only opportunity I have to make sure that the warrant in this case wasn't issued because of corruption and because of fraud. Also, I wanted to clear up some things that were stated by opposing counsel. So there was no claim of abandonment of any Fourth Amendment claims. There was a claim that we had for First Amendment retaliation that we dismissed prior to summary judgment because we didn't think that that claim was well supported. That has nothing to do with the Fourth Amendment. Counsel also stated that there was no notice for the city of Detroit that there were any constitutional claims in the lawsuit, which I'm very puzzled about because the claim is entitled Fourth Amendment violation, search and seizure. There was some talk about incidental things found in the house. There was no admission on anything found in the house. Obviously, anything in the house is fruits of an unlawful search, especially this fraudulent warrant. But more importantly, I think we asked to inspect the alleged substances, and they were unable to produce them. So did they find something? I don't know. I don't think it's relevant. I think that it's just something that goes into this case to kind of sweeten it up for the defendant.
Well, Mr. Razor, can I ask you this? Is the bloody shirt in the record?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay. Thank you.
100%. As a matter of fact, we brought it to the first status conference with the magistrate, and he remarked, there's a significant quantity of blood that as a result of this drawer being slammed into her while she was on the other side. And the court even stated, the court presumed that there was a factual dispute. The district judge stated
even if the factual dispute exists as the precise waiting period, and even if the jury could find that the waiting period was unreasonable, so I mean, the judge kind of presumed that there was a factual dispute, and then dismissed it on qualified immunity, which was never briefed by anybody. And Judge Clay, you're right, I mean, you should have an opportunity to brief something like that. It wasn't argued by the city that qualified immunity was an issue, and then all of a sudden it was opinion. And at the time that the decision was made on a summary judgment motion, the complaint had been amended to clearly indicate this not been announced. It was only after the motion for reconsideration that all of a sudden that the judge indicated that she should not have amended the complaint.
Mr. Razor, I just have a quick question. Your time is expiring. So when we look at whether there was a dispute of fact or dispute of facts in connection with knock and announce, does it matter that there's conflicting testimony about how close the bathroom was located to the front door, whether the door to the bathroom was open or shut? I think she says it was open. I think she says that the bathroom was close to the front door. The officers seem to construe that, if I'm correct, as the bathroom being farther from the door and the door being shut so that maybe she wouldn't hear because of that and maybe couldn't get there as quickly. She says she was not using a cane and she was only about 8 steps away, I think, from the front door. Are those facts that we consider in terms of whether there's a dispute as to reasonableness of the announcement here?
Well, I mean, I think the district court acknowledged that there's a factual dispute as to what happened and whether there was a knock and announce. And certainly those are facts, but 6 to 8 seconds is 6 to 8 seconds. And the fact was is that everybody agreed that from the time they got out of their Detroit police van till the time they bashed on the door was 6 to 8 seconds. They didn't knock and announce at the door. They came out of a van yelling DPD. This is an older home that has a closed-in front porch with a door, and then has a front door inside of it. There is no way in the middle of the day that anybody would be expected to reasonably hear people yelling on the lawn. That could be kids coming home from school, that could be kids playing outside, that could be, you know, any sort of thing. The fact is that everybody really is 6 to 8 seconds from the time they get out of the vehicle to the time that they got bashed on the door. I think that as a matter of, obviously there's a factual dispute, as you pointed out, Judge Paul, as to whether or not it was reasonable.
Yeah, well, haven't some courts, maybe even our court, said that 5 seconds is a sufficient amount of time?
Well, I think it's in that case where they said 5 seconds was enough time, the officer had not been announced at the door. I think that's a case where the officer announced, and then the officer hears footsteps, thinking that somebody's walking away, then the officer unlocks the open door, if I remember that case right. But this is not a case where there was a 5, 6 to 8 seconds at the door, and there was then some sort of noise inside of the house, like for exigent circumstances. This is 6 to 8 seconds total from the time they get out of the van on the street until the time that they bash down the door. And there's a factual dispute, and the fact finder should decide whether that's reasonable. And you should know whether the warrant was obtained by fraud in this investigation. Because imagine a situation where you later find out in the newspaper.
Mr. Razor, excuse me. I think we've got that argument down. So thank you for presenting the case today, both counsel, and the case will be submitted. And the clerk may call the next case.
Yes, Your Honor.